Chapter 14 Of Mice and Moustaches. Molly was on her knees, scrubbing the hall floor, but she struggled to her feet, hauling herself up with a soapy hand on my sleeve when I went to see if she was all right. She had been moaning so loudly that I could hear her from my bedroom at the back of the house on the second floor.
"Oh, miss!"
Her eyes were even more darkly underbagged than usual.
"I can't not be all right, can I?"
She noticed the suds on my dress and gave them a quick rub with her raw, wet hand.
"Oh, what a night! I had a terrible dream!"
She dropped her brush in the bucket, splattering my hem with dirty water, and folded her arms in preparation for her narration.
"I was sitting in Mr. Cheek's armchair with my feet up by the fire, and him feeding me hot butter muffins, and you fetching me a big pot of tea and trying to curtsy like a proper lady's maid, when I felt it a scritch and heard wrestling noises on my head, and when I put my hand up, I undiscovered a huge teensy mass making its nest in my ears, and when I pulled it out by the tail, it bit me."
She held out her hand to show me two neat puncture marks on her right forefinger. "Oh, so it was not a dream then," I remarked, and Molly wrinkled her brow.
"Not a dream when, miss?"
She poked her finger towards her eye. "Not a dream at all," I said, nearly as confused as she was, and Molly laughed.
"Ah, miss, how can a dream not be a dream?"
She rotated the finger horizontally. I tried again. "No, I meant the mouse."
"But..."
Molly licked her finger and thought about the taste of it.
"How can a mouse be a dream anyway?"
She had another lick and smacked her lips.
"When Mr. Grice..."
Molly crossed herself.
"Caught a mouse in his strangulator. He didn't not say..."
Molly's voice rose in an uncannily inaccurate imitation of her employer.
"Oh! By George, I has in captured a dream."
I covered my mouth and pretended to cough. "So what happened to the mouse?" I asked, still unclear as to whether it had existed outside Molly's unusual brain. Molly sniffed.
"I thought you would have been more worried about what happened to me,"
she sniffed again. I glanced at the grandmother clock and wondered if time were going backwards. "So what did happen to you?" I asked reluctantly. Molly made a noise that I can only describe as a snorkle.
"Well, I swallowed it, of course,"
she told me, it being inconceivable to her that anyone in their right mind would have done anything different. "Oh!" I had been driven mad by drugs 18 months ago, and Molly was having much the same effect. "Is it still in your stomach?" Molly made a sort of chundling sound.
"Still? It ain't anything but still."
She put a hand to her left bosom.
"It's running about in there like a..."
She struggled for the apposite word.
"Gravestone."
I went into the study where Sidney Grice was sifting through his mail.
"An epistle from Pound,"
he announced.
"He has wearied of dealing with Fenland creatures in uniform and taken a temporary posting in Limehouse."
I adopted a casual pose by the fireplace. "When does he return?"
"On Thursday."
My guardian put the letter in the top drawer of his desk, and my foolish heart turned over. I was so desperate, and yet so afraid to meet George again, and I could not help but remember a time when he would have sent that message to me. Molly answered the doorbell.
"Probably two callers,"
Mr. G murmured without glancing up. "How can you tell?"
"By listening to the footfalls."
"They could be carrying a third person," I teased, as he filled his Grice patent fountain pen from his Grice inkwell, which he had not patented, as he wished to keep the design a secret.
"I considered that possibility and dismissed it."
He wiped the back of the nib on his blotting paper.
"They would be dragging their boots more."
"Or in their stockinged feet?"
"Which is why I said probably."
Molly entered, bearing a tray and shutting the door, and Mr. G inhaled.
"A well-to-do man and a woman," he declared, to judge from the scents of expensive feminine perfume and masculine pomade, which even Molly cannot completely overpower.
Molly brought the tray over.
"I swallowed her,"
she began, forgetting that her employer was apparently able not just to hear a pin drop, but, I sometimes suspected, a pin as it was falling.
"Mouse."
Mr. G slid the cards off like a poker player.
"Told you!"
Molly folded her arms triumphantly. Sidney Grice titivated his perfectly pinned cravat.
"Bring them in."
He slipped the cards into one of his many waistcoat pockets.
"Mr. and Mrs. Wright,"
Molly announced, to everyone's apparent satisfaction. It was not like her to get even the simplest of names right. Sidney Grice shook their hands and introduced me. They were a small couple, short and delicately boned, their faces grey and stretched with anxiety. I ushered Mrs. Wright towards my armchair, but she demurred and sat between me and her husband in one of the two upright chairs that he had dragged over, sitting beside Mr. G, so that we were all in a semicircle round the hearth.
"Thank you for seeing us,"
Mrs. Wright began.
"The only gratitude I seek is of a monetary nature,"
he told her so softly that he might have been making a pleasantry.
"I shall not beat about the bush,"
Mr. Wright promised.
"But you are already doing so,"
Mr. G assured him, with an unnerving light smile upon his lips.
"It is Albatoria, Mr. Grice." "What is?"
He tapped his own left knee to hurry things along, and it was just as well that I did not make my guess, which was that they were referring to a monument, because Mrs. Wright trembled and told us,
"Albatoria is our daughter."
"Or was,"
Mr. Wright whispered.
"Do not."
Mrs. Wright sobbed, and her husband took her hand.
"I pray that I am wrong."
Sidney Grice opened his mouth, but for once he paid heed to my warning cough and glare that this was not the time to demonstrate his notorious lack of tact.
"Is she missing?"
I asked. Mr. Wright tilted his head right back, and his wife lowered hers miserably.
"Since the night of Saturday the 2nd of August," she said.
"At what time and where did you last see her?" I tried, though the date was horribly familiar, and Mr. G had perked up on hearing it.
"She was a vexatious girl,"
Mr. Wright burst out.
"Not bad,"
his wife protested mildly, "just high-spirited."
"I do not believe, because I have no reason to do so, that Miss Middleton's interrogation incorporated a supplementary question regarding your incongruously labelled progeny's character,"
Mr. G remarked, the hand on his knee fluttering rapidly now.
"Perhaps I could entice you to satisfy her curiosity."
Mrs. Wright put her hand into the small satin handbag on her lap.
"At about 9 o'clock that night,"
she told me,
"she said her wisdom tooth was hurting, and she wanted an early night."
Mr. Wright forced his head up as if his neck were rusty.
"At about 10:30, I sent Anne Jane, our maid, to check if Albatoria was asleep, only to be informed that she was not in her room, and her bed had not been slept in." "And how did the put-upon Anne Jane ascertain that last allegation?"
My guardian's hand stopped about 4 inches above his leg. Mr. Wright puzzled for a few seconds.
"Because the sheets had not been disturbed." "And your daughter could not possibly have straightened them or plumped up a pillow?"
Mr. G leapt in.
"Well, I suppose suppositions are of slight use to me."
Sidney Grice ignored my mouthed entreaties.
"You must approach a greater degree of accuracy if you wish to avail yourself of some of my superlative powers."
Mrs. Wright withdrew a tiny square of white lace from her handbag and dabbed the corners of her eyes, and her husband's jaw muscles bunched angrily.
"Can you describe your daughter?" I asked.
"They would be even poorer parents than they seem if they could not,"
my guardian muttered.
"Now see here,"
Mr. Wright squared up to the detective.
"I see everywhere that can be seen."
Sidney Grice tossed his head.
16,
Mrs. Wright said.
About your height and build, but pretty. Lovely auburn hair and beautiful green eyes.
We shall need some more details if we are to help you find her, I began.
And a sweet little freckle here.
Mrs. Wright dabbed the left side of her nose and burst out with,
Oh, I'm so afraid.
Mr. Wright leaned over and squeezed his wife's shoulder.
We must be brave for Albertoria, my dear,
he encouraged her, before turning back to the detective.
You see, Mr. Grice, we fear...
His voice cracked, but he fought to continue.
We fear that our daughter may have been found and lost already.
Sidney Grice seemed lost in thought, but his face glowed. I never met a man so entranced by the prospect of death.